Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill is back focused on the nation's fiscal problems just 2 weeks after her way larger than expected win over Todd Akin. The polls showed her up by just 5 points heading into the final weekend, but she won by 16. We'll find out why when she joins us later this hour. But first, Budweiser. Sure, the beer was a ginormous success. It wasn't called the king of beers for nothing. But the family behind all that success was not nearly as appealing. A new book explores the Bush dynasty across 5 generations. It ends with a look at the sale of the brewing giant to InBev in 2008 and the decline of August Bush IV, who wound up at home surrounded by stacks of loaded guns while he spiraled into a world of depression and drugs. William Nadelseeder is the author of a new book, Bitter Brew, The Rise and Fall of Anheuser-Busch and America's Kings of Beer. He spent 12 years as a reporter at the Los Angeles Times. He's also the author of I'm Dying Up Here, Heartbreak and High Times in Stand-Up Comedy's Golden Era. Bill Nadelseeder joins us this morning from the studios of KCSN in Northridge, California. Bill, so good to have you. Good morning.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
This book has been optioned to the company that produces Mad Men for a reason. And I guess that's the rise and fall of this company, which has so many self-centered men in it. But the rise and fall of August Bush IV is maybe the most intriguing part of this book, if only because he was the last Bush at the helm of this company. Anheuser-Busch was sold to InBev back in 2008. August Bush IV, Bill, walked away with $100 million. Then what happened to him?
Well, you can buy a lot of temptation with $100 million.
Yes, you can.
He apparently had longstanding substance abuse issues going back to when he was very young, just out of college or in college. And it was never really dealt with. His friends and the people around him thought it was recreational. Apparently it was much more than that. So when all of a sudden he was untethered from the company and didn't have any responsibilities anymore and felt very bad that the company went down on his watch, as he said, he spiraled into depression and extreme drug usage, which led to hallucinations and sort of holding up in his home. And it eventually led to a young woman being found dead in his bed of a drug overdose, which was at least the most recent scandal of the Bush family. He is the last king of beer.
Yeah. And the woman was found dead, and her son, this 8-year-old boy, had moved in with them, was spending time there, wandering around the house that's filled with these very powerful guns, all loaded, right?
Well, yeah, there were 900 paramilitary-style weapons in his house.
900?
900, yeah. Wow. It's a very large house.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
so there's plenty of room for that sort of thing. But, you know, people in the staff were disturbed by this. I mean, it's a gated compound, 10 acres. And so, you know, he's hidden from the view of the world. But, you know, they were worried about the little boy walking around unattended among all these guns. I mean, they were just stacked up here and there. Sort of born of paranoia. He was convinced that someone was out there in the woods coming to get him all the time. And it was, you know, a result of a combination of drugs that he was taking, according to affidavits that his family filled out when they applied to a judge for a involuntary commitment order for him. Whereupon the local police force showed up at his house and literally took him into custody against his will and took him to the hospital, and they shipped him off to rehab. So you had basically a publicly funded intervention of one of the most well-known people in St. Louis, which was not reported anywhere until the book.
But the intervention occurs, and then he heads back home and sort of starts all over again, doesn't he?
Well, yeah, he did his 30 days that he was ordered to take and went right back home. The guns were all legally purchased, so they were given back to him. And, you know, the girlfriend and the little boy, her little boy moved back in, and things proceeded apace until, she died one night of an overdose of both. The autopsy showed she had a fatal amount of both cocaine and oxycodone in her.
And at one point, the Missouri Department of Social Services gets involved. What happened to trigger that intervention there?
Well, that was the intervention I was talking about, mm-hmm. where the police came. What they did was that the parents, his mother and sister, responding to concern from the staff inside the house, called Child Protective Services because he'd fired off guns a number of times in the house, and they're pretty high-powered weapons. One of them put a bullet through several walls. And so they got the Child Protective Services to send someone over there. And for whatever reason, they didn't do anything. Apparently, he convinced them that everything was okay, or maybe they didn't see the guns pile up on the table or whatever. And they didn't do anything. And that's when they decided that, well, we're going to have to go to a judge here and convince him that the public and his own life is in danger here and the little boys.
And what happened then?
That's when they showed up and they took him into custody. Right. They used a ruse to get in the gates because it was all set up so that he had to let people in. So they used that same Child Protective Services person to buzz the gate. And when he let the person in, you know, the police came in behind her.
We're visiting with Bill Nadelsieder about his new book, Bitter Brew, The Rise and Fall of Anheuser-Busch and America's Kings of Beer. What's August Bush IV doing today?
Well, he's still living in the house. He's making telling people that he's getting sober. Remains to be seen. That would be great if he did that. He will survive. I mean, a lot of his friends told me when I was talking to him that they didn't expect him to survive long. But I've been being told that for 2 years, you know, where some friends say he won't make his next birthday, and he would. And they were telling me that when, you know, before all this happened. I was surprised when the girlfriend was found dead in his bed. I was working on the book at the time. And from what his friends had said, I was surprised that it was her and not him. So he could be, if he really did the work and got sober, he could be the greatest spokesman for sobriety ever. He could save thousands of lives. And, you know, he could write a book and get booked on every show there is, but it's up to him.
Is he interested in that or do you know?
I don't know. I mean, some of his friends say we hope so, but they don't think so. You know, there's no way to tell. You know?
How did he react to your book?
I don't really know. I don't imagine that he's particularly happy about it. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard anything personally.
You know, this wasn't the first time that a woman was found dead sort of alongside him. There's another story in this book about August the 4th, I guess. It involves an incident extremely reminiscent of the Ted Kennedy deal and what happened with him at Chappaquiddick in the late 1960s. Bill, walk us through that.
Well, it occurred at the University of Arizona when he was 19. He was a freshman or sophomore. And one night after, hitting a couple bars, he picked up a waitress at one of these places, and they drove off into the night in his Corvette. And the next morning, the police found the Corvette turned upside down on the side of the road, and the young woman who was with him was laying on the side of the road, and she was dead, and he was gone. He had walked back to his apartment, and, he was all bloody, and he was injured. The story was he didn't remember anything. When the police finally showed up at his place, tracked him down from various things in the car, he said he didn't remember what had happened, didn't even know if he'd been driving. And a long, drawn-out sort of investigation went on. They took a blood test. They took blood from him right away. And the hospital, in the first time that anyone ever remembers, lost the blood sample. So they never were able to make a case against him, and he was not prosecuted. He went back to St. Louis.
And just like the Kennedys, I mean, August Bush IV had lawyers around him handling this case and sort of slowing down the works for the police right from the get-go, right?
Oh, well, for sure. I mean, you know, he's from a very wealthy family. His father would do anything to protect, you know, his son and the family name. I guess they sort of believed his story. you know, that he didn't remember, and he had an accident. He was going too fast. I mean, there's in the history of the Bush family, they always loved fast cars. The men in the family, the guys that ran the company, you know, fast cars, you know, fast women, you know, mm-hmm. loaded weapons, alcohol. You know, that's sort of that's the male curriculum for Bush family men. You know. So there was nothing unusual about this. Every member of the male member of the Bush family who took over the company, you know, enjoyed a well-funded period of sowing oats before they were expected to settle down and get married and run the company. The difference with August the 4th is that he never really got to that settle down phase. And, you know, so 30 years after this 22-year-old woman, you know, died in his presence with drugs in her system, you know, another one. He's now 40 some years old, but the woman's the same age. You know, she's 27. So, you know, most men can go through their whole lives without having a woman die in their presence with drugs in their system, much less two. So that's sort of a, you know, that's a red flag that maybe your lifestyle is, you know, a little out of control. Yeah.
There's another moment in this book that really struck me. There's a meeting, I believe it's a meeting of shareholders, and August Bush the Fourth takes the stage. But he was so incoherent that he was eventually led away. This was, I think, shortly before the sale of the company. What happened there, Bill?
Well, yes, that wasn't shareholders, it was distributors.
Distributors,
and they were at a World Beer Convention in Washington, D.C. So everyone in the industry was there. This was, you know, a fairly visible place. And he was supposed to speak to them in the afternoon. He showed up late, and they were apologizing for his tardiness, mm-hmm. and he stepped up to speak to the crowd of 500 or so, you know, Anheuser-Busch distributors, and basically could not deliver his lines, slurred his words, stumbled over everything, and had to be led off, you know, away from the stage. And, you know, he's apparently not feeling well. And they said that he'd taken some sort of cold medicine or something like that. But he was clearly, you know, under the influence of something more than alcohol. And this went around the convention really fast. I mean, you know, this was in broad daylight in front of everybody that this happened. And, you know, InBev people, you know, were around, that they heard about this. And then it wasn't, you know, I don't know, maybe a month later that InBev made their bid to take over Anheuser-Busch. And that's there really wasn't much drama after that. I mean, mm-hmm. they made an offer to buy Anheuser-Busch that kind of couldn't be turned down. Mm-hmm. And what August 4th's father, August the 3rd, and the board did was they managed to get the price up higher so that everyone who had Anheuser-Busch stock did very, very well, including the family. But they had no defense. They couldn't not sell because they didn't control enough stock to turn it aside.
Hmm. Again, we're visiting with Bill Nadelsieder, his new book, Bitter Brew. It's a story of the rise and fall of the Anheuser-Busch dynasty over in St. Louis. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or you can go to KCUR's Facebook page. Ken from Lee's Summit. Ken, good morning. You there, Ken? He wanted to know about previous arrests of August Bush the Fourth. What can you tell us about that, Bill?
Well, he was arrested for the thing in Arizona. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, he was arrested after a car chase with police in St. Louis. They pulled him over for speeding. It was some narcotics cops on the way home, and they, you know, after a shift, and his car went speeding by, and it looked like a car that they thought belonged to a well-known drug dealer in town. So they figured, oh well, we got reason here to pull him over and search his car. So they pulled him over, and then he stopped, and then he took off, and they chased him around town for 15 minutes at high speeds, and they eventually, thinking he was a drug dealer, and they eventually, you know, brought him to a stop by literally leaning out the window of one of the patrol cars. There were three cars in pursuit, and shooting out his back tire.
Oh my!
And then, of course, when they went up to the car, they're expecting this drug dealer, and they see this clean-cut college kid, and realize, oh my God, this is the son of August Bush the Third. You know, the Bush families, we're really in it now, because they knew right then that this was, you know, bad publicity going to happen, and there's going to be politics involved. But there was nothing they could do. They had stopped him. This whole chase was on the radio, you know, the police radio. You know, they had to take him in. I mean, they would have preferred at that point to just let it go, just in terms of their own careers and lives. Oh my God, what a headache this is, you know. But it, again, you know, the family marshaled the best lawyers in town, and you know, they beat the prosecution. They argued that, you know, these were plainclothes narcotics officers, and he was afraid for his life, and he thought he was going to be killed and kidnapped, so that's why he was running away. And, you know, the jury bought that.
Jeez. You know, and given all this, why is August Bush IV made the chairman of the board at such a key time in the company's history? I get he's the oldest son. That's the way it's always been done. But clearly there were issues here. So why go there?
Well, it goes back to many years, I think. His father, August III, took over the company from his father, the legendary beer baron Gussie Bush.
Mm-hmm.
The story at the time was in 1975 that Gussie, who was just really, really famous, and he's the guy who bought the Cardinals, and, you know, he was the beer baron of America,
mm-hmm.
That he, you know, when he got to be 75, he graciously stepped aside for his son. That wasn't true. That was a story they put out. Actually, it was a boardroom coup, and August the 3rd deposed him and shoved his own father out with good reason, you know, and it caused a big split in the family. You had to take sides if you were in the Bush family. Were you with Gussie or were you with August the 3rd in this? And in the end, you know, they history showed that August the 3rd made the right decision because Gussie was having a lot of problems. You know, his young daughter had been killed in a car accident. He was drinking heavily. He was erratic. It was bad for the company. So he had to go. And August the 3rd sort of bit the bullet and deposed his father. But, you know, this affected him. I mean, he felt guilty about this all his life. So then, you know, 20 some years later, his son is the president of the company. And he probably knows that there's a problem here, and he's always sort of been really tough on him, and their relationship is not good. But then he's faced with, well, do I make him the chairman of the company, or do I depose him like I did my dad?
Hmm.
I mean, that's a tough thing to do. And this is a little nickel-dime psychology on my part, I have to admit, because he's not telling the story of why, and he probably never will. But one could imagine that what he kept doing is, you know, as I said, double down. He kept doubling down on the bloodline, thinking that August the 4th, his son, would finally get it together, you know, and run the company. And it proved to be not the case. Mm. Or time ran out for them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The beer business was such that, you know, the big, you know, voracious conglomerates were looking for people to buy, and they had no defense, and they were gobbled up.
This is an amazing family, isn't it, Bill?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, when I went back to St. Louis, I'm from there. I grew up there, so I grew up steeped in this story. And, you know, if the original Bush, Adolphus Bush, who got off a steamboat there in St. Louis in 1857, if he hadn't arrived, or if he'd gone on to Cleveland, say, and if his son hadn't managed to keep that brewery open and operating during Prohibition and the Depression, and if his son hadn't bought the St. Louis Cardinals, it's hard to imagine what the story of St. Louis would be, or what it would be like, because they had that much of an effect on that city. And they are both beloved, and people are disappointed that they sold the brewery, and, you know, they're you know, it's a very complex relationship, the citizenry of St. Louis and the Bush family and that brewery.
Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, up to date@kcur.org. Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering, sir, is there an August Bush the 5th? And if there is, could you give us some facts about him, please?
Ah,
there is not. August the 4th has no children. He was married for a couple years, but he does not have any children. That's why I say he's the last. He will be the last king of beer, at least as far as the Bush, Anheuser-Busch is concerned. There is another beer company that has been started up.
I was going to ask you about that, because one of the offspring is going in the same direction, right?
Yeah, the Gussie Bush had 11 children from three marriages, and he has the third marriage produced 7 children, four males. And when Gussie died, he left them all a load of stock. And one of them, Billy, never sold any of his stock. So when they bought the brewery for $70 a share, Billy made, you know, a couple hundred million dollars or so. And he decided he would start up another beer company because he thought his family should be in the beer business. After 150 years, they weren't. They weren't part of being an employer in St. Louis. So he started up a new beer company. So they're now he's like Adolphus getting off the boat again. He's the littlest guy in town, but he's got a lot of family history and stuff behind him. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Yeah, how's that company doing? Do you have any idea?
You know, I'm told from people I know who work for the company, they've captured 1% of the market in St. Louis, so they're doing very well. They're being sold at Busch Stadium, which is a big deal. The company is called Kräftig, which is, you know, stands for strength or something like that in German.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we'll see. It's interesting. You know, we'll see if people's affection for the Busch family transfers on to that beer. You know, it's hard to launch a beer.
Kevin, thanks for the call. Tell us a little more, Bill, about InBev and why did that group want this company so badly?
Well, InBev was a company that did not exist in 2004, 4 years before they acquired the largest brewer in the world, or what was, you know, at one point the largest brewer. They were basically InBev was the people behind it were three Brazilian billionaires who had made their money partly by owning the Brazilian Walmart. And they started this is all part of globalization. They started buying up these great old breweries around the world, you know, 600-year-old breweries in Munich and whatnot. And they put together what was basically a large portfolio of beer brands. And, you know, August the 3rd, who was a great CEO who took that company from, you know, 10 million barrels a year to 100 million barrels a year after deposing his father, did not join in the buying up other breweries the way these guys did. He could have. He chose not to. That's one of the great mysteries of why he didn't. I think it was probably because he was such a stickler for controlling the process and all that, and it's hard to do when you have partners strung out across the globe. But they started buying up all the other breweries, and all of a sudden they were bigger than Anheuser-Busch. You know, they ate all the little fishes, and all of a sudden they were this giant whale, and he wasn't quite so big. People consider that one of the mistakes he made. He didn't make a lot of mistakes, but that's one big one he made. And the other was, of course, to keep promoting his son.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
Hey, how is the Budweiser brand doing these days?
Not well. I mean, the guys, the InBev guys, you know, they're not brewers in that sense. And they don't have the same family pride that the Busch family had in their product. You know, the company is making more money, and they've cut costs drastically, and they've cut all the things that they used to give to charity and the things that really built their connection with the community. They've cut all that back. But they're not building those brands. And, you know, critics will say that what they're really doing is they're just doing this and trying to get as much profit out of it as they can, as much return to investors as they can. And they don't really care that much about the future of those brands because they're eventually going to make a play for PepsiCo. And that's their big game.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's not the company it was. It doesn't have the magic it used to have. It probably doesn't have the same loyalty of its workers. Certainly doesn't have the same loyalty of St. Louis. You know, there's a lot of hurt feelings there in St. Louis because they lost an awful lot of jobs. And that was – St. Louis was always so proud of that company. And people in St. Louis, every time they would hear a commercial that at the end would say, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri, it made them feel good.
Yeah.
That town lost a lot, you know, from Prohibition on. So – it's a complicated relationship there.
William Nadelsieder is our guest. He's the author of Bitter Brew, The Rise and Fall of Anheuser-Busch and America's Kings of Beer. He joins us this morning from Northridge, California. Let's walk through some history a little bit here, Bill. How did the brewery first begin? It's a great story. Tell us how all that came together.
Well, Adolphus Busch arrived in this country from Germany, from Bavaria. He was 18 and had a little money. Came from a well-to-do family. He landed in New Orleans, and he was part of a Teutonic tide that arrived in America around that time. I mean, 7.5 million immigrants started arriving around the middle of the 1800s, and you know, a huge proportion of them were from beer drinking countries, you know, Ireland, England, and Germany. And unlike the Irish, who arrived in this country basically starving and had to fight their way block by block into Manhattan and New York, the Germans tended to arrive with more money. They were and they came into the interior of the country. So Adolphus was one of those people. And they, as they moved down the Mississippi River Valley, they started breweries because that's what they knew. And they were serving their own people who were arriving. Adolphus arrived in St. Louis. There were 40 different breweries operating in St. Louis, you know, when he arrived, and they were basically almost neighborhood breweries. If you lived in this neighborhood, you bought beer from the Green Tree Brewery or whatever else. He bought a supply business that supplied, you know, breweries with stuff. You know, he wasn't a brewer, and one of his customers was a guy by the name of Eberhard Anheuser, who took ownership of a failing, you know, bad brewery from an unpaid debt. And so he invited Adolphus, you know, to help him out, and he eventually married Eberhard Anheuser's daughter and acquired a less than controlling interest in the company, but took it over. And he was, again, he was a brilliant industrialist, and he really turned it into something. He was the first guy who figured out, you know, how to that you could pasteurize
beer. I was going to say, he really had that figured out way ahead of time, and that was so important. Why, Bill?
Well, because again, a beer, you know, you couldn't refrigerate it at the time. So one of the reasons St. Louis was a big brewery site is they had caves underground there, so you could cool the beer. And as long as you could keep it fresh for as long as you could, that was a good thing. Well, he figured out if you pasteurize it, he'd read about the pasteurizing of wine, and he did it to beer. So all of a sudden, he could ship his beer outside, not outside the neighborhood, outside St. Louis, outside the state, around the country, and he figured that out before anyone else did. And in doing so, and then, of course, what he did was he was smart enough to realize, well, you know, I should buy the company that makes the rail cars. I should buy the ice companies that have to provide the ice. He bought all these. He did vertical integration before there was a name for it. So all of a sudden, he had whereas, you know, most beers were regional at best, he had the first national brand of beer, and there was no one who could really compete with that. By the turn of the century, Anheuser-Busch and Budweiser were the number one brewer in the country.
It happened that quickly.
Well, it was some 20, 30 years. But
yeah.
Again, he was helped by the influx of Germans. He was the one who really figured out that, you know what, you know, beer can become this country's national drink. Up until that time, it was whiskey. All right, and it did become the national drink of America. We were not a beer drinking nation, and you know, by the turn of the century, we were the number one beer producer in the world, ahead of Germany. So he sort of saw all that, and kept plowing profits back into his company and building it, and that's what happened.
Well, you mentioned profits, Bill, and there were a whole lot of profits associated with this business. How did the family, at least in the early generations, begin to handle all this wealth and success that came their way?
Well, they lavished it upon themselves. You know, they were part of the robber baron. It's the Gilded Age. You know, he had mansions in Pasadena, St. Louis, Cooperstown, New York, and a castle in Germany. And he you know, flitted between one another depending on the season. You know, their home, the family home in St. Louis is astonishing. It's a, you know, Grant's Farm. It's one of the, you know, it's Missouri's version of Hearst Castle. That was built by his son, August A. Bush, and spectacular place. And so they live very, very well. They it was the immigrant's dream, man. They made a lot of money. They had, it opened, doors to power, you know, the succeeding CEOs, you know, August A. Bush and his son, Gussie Bush, became political kingmakers in St. Louis and nationally. I mean, you know, Gussie Bush's friends were Lyndon Johnson and Harry Truman, and he hung out with them, and, you know, and they drank together, and it was, you know, this was a magical life they lived. And you know, celebrities all came to St. Louis to visit Gussie's mansion, and it was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, Grant's Farm was like Camelot.
Hmm. the rise and fall of the Bush family, Anheuser-Busch. That's our topic today. We're visiting with William Nadelsieder. He's the author of Bitter Brew. Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888. Bruce from Lawrence. Bruce, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I grew up in Kansas, and I remember Coors was king in Kansas, and you could not buy it in Missouri. And I was wondering if the Bushes use their political strength to keep that from happening. I know when I was younger, the more industrious friends of mine would smuggle Coors in and sell it on the Missouri side of Kansas City for quite a profit.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I remember that because I went to the University of Missouri, and where I majored in Budweiser, by the way. And we used to, and I have a lot of friends in Kansas City. It's one of the great cities in America. And we used to go to Kansas City, you know, just to get Coors because it was like the forbidden drink. You couldn't get it, you know, in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And I think it was, we would go over to the Kansas side where you could get 3-2 Coors. And I don't think it was the Bush that kept them out so much as Coors not wanting to expand into a very competitive territory. It's interesting that the Bushes and the Coors family were close. A lot of the German families were close. They all knew each other. They socialized. You know, the people who owned Schlitz, you know, the E-Lines, and the Coors family, they all knew each other. At one time, one of the E-Line family that owned Coors, one of the E-Line sons and the and Adolphus Bush the IV, they pledged the same fraternity at the University of Colorado, which must have made the fraternity guys feel like they'd gone to beer heaven. I can imagine the promotional products they had at their parties, you know.
We just have a minute left, Bill. Who came up with the Clydesdales?
Gussie Bush did that, the beer baron.
That's
Bush the second. He's Bush the second.
Okay.
August Bush the second.
Okay.
Gussie. He'd be August Bush the third's father. And that came right out of the during the Depression when they were getting ready to gear back up again. I mean, not Depression, Prohibition. He went out and bought some a bunch of them, 15 of them, something like that, from the Chicago stockyards, and got an old beer wagon and painted it up like it looked in the days when they delivered their beer by horse-drawn carriage, and presented it to his father as a gift. The beer was put back, you know, was made legal again, they sent the Clydesdales, you know, down Pennsylvania Avenue with a case of beer for Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was the guy who ended Prohibition, you know, of beer especially.
That's Bill Nadelsieder. He's the author of Bitter Brew, The Rise and Fall of Anheuser-Busch and America's Kings of Beer. Bill, I sure enjoyed having you. Thanks for taking some time today.
Great to be in here. Thanks.
All the best, Bill. You bet.